Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
It was the best of time. It was the worst.
She was the people's princess.
To fight on the beaches.
Away, man. These are the things that made England.
To fight on the landing ground.
These are the things that made England.
I have the body but of a weak and feeble woman.
These are the things that made England.
And the King of England, too.
These are the things that made England.
Cry God for Harry!
And these are the things that made England.
England! And St. George!
These are the things that made England.
Before we start, let me tell you about a great sponsor we've got at the moment called OnlineGreatBooks.com. This is your chance to learn about all the great works that change history, and you can get a discount by going to OnlineGreatBooks.com/ref/ENG and enter the promotional code ENG to get a 25% discount off your first 3 months. But go and have a look at OnlineGreatBooks.com and see what it's all about. Hello then, everybody. Welcome to the Things That Made England. My name is David Crowther from the History of England, and I'm joined by
Royfield Brown from 10 American Presidents, Mid-Atlantic, Dum-de-Dum, Friday 15.
So look, Royfield, this week is my week. So I am going to introduce something which I think ought to go into the cabinet, and you're going to push me around a bit. And then we'll decide at the end. So my contention is that English accents are one of the glories of England. They're one of the things that makes England what it is. They ought to go into the cabinet. Okay? Why would I be proposing that? For me, the accents is all about the variety, the diversity, although that's a horribly popular word, and there's the rich tapestry of England's history and of our culture. The thing we know about England is that, you know, loads of people have come here and come to stay, and that's one of the triumphs of our culture and our history and our society. And it's been with us, that diversity has been with us forever. So there's a story about William Caxton. Do you know William Caxton?
Oh, yeah, the printer bloke.
The printer bloke, the first English printer, first British printer, in fact. And he's trying to do some of his first books, and he's saying one of the problems is that all the words are different. So he hears a conversation between some merchants. One of them produces eggs, talks about eggs, and another one talks about eieren. Completely different words for the same thing. So nobody knows how to spell anything. Nobody knows what the pronunciations, because people in some parts of the country couldn't even understand others. So I had a look on the internet, Royfield, because I thought that's what you prepare from these programs.
Extensive research was done.
Extensive research with all the experts. Mm-hmm. I didn't have time for that, so I went on the internet. And there are various different articles between 200 and 700 dialects in England, depending on what you read. Wikipedia tells me there is an accent called Smoggy. Have you come across that?
No.
Nor I. What is Smoggy? And the entry was clearly written by somebody from Hartlepool. I actually can't remember why now. But anyway, Smoggy. So there's one. So when I was a lad, Royfield, I used to have a job in a warehouse, summer job in a warehouse, in a place called Anstey. Okay?
Yeah.
Anstey is 5 miles from Loughborough-ish, 7 miles from Leicester-ish. Might be the way around, actually. And in Anstey, they took the mick out of the accents of the people from Loughborough and from Leicester. And they could demonstrate what the difference was. So there you've got a spread of 15 miles, and in that 15 miles, the accents were recognisably different between Loughborough, Anstey and Leicester.
It is one of the amazing things about England that you can just go, as you said, you know, 5 miles and hear a complete and utter accent shift. For me, being a Brummie, going from Birmingham into what we call the Black Country was always just a marvel for me, that the way that their accents just changed so fast.
Just and go and ask for a curry in Dudley.
It's just when I first went to the Black Country, so my uncle used to be a primary school teacher.
Right.
And for about 3 years, for me between the ages of 7 and 10, I'd have a week out of school where I would go with him and he'd go camping with his school in the Black Country. And yeah. I remember the first year hearing those accents, I just thought the kids were taking the mick. water. And they say, you am for you are. You am going down the road. And it was my first real exposure to another English accent other than Cockney.
Right.
And I just couldn't. And it was 5 miles down the road, David.
It's amazing, isn't it? See, that's a fantastic thing. So you mentioned your Brummie. I found this survey of the relative popularities of all different
accents. I think I know where you're going with this.
Slightly irritatingly, this survey seems to be a British Isles survey, so it's got Southern Irish and Welsh in it. And you won't be surprised for them that Southern Irish and Welsh come right at the top. You know, which is slightly irritating as an Englishman, but there you go. They are both. I've got to say. Out of 12, one being popular, 12 being the least popular, where would you put Brummie?
Well, okay. Now,
that's
I know.
Just answer the question.
I'm going to answer it in a very correct manner. Right.
Are you a politician?
Not yet.
I'm looking for a yes and no answer.
Okay, David.
Pick a number, Roger.
David.
1 to 12.
Can I answer? You're asking me a question. Let me answer.
Go on.
Right. Quite simply, the accent
in
the popular English consciousness that is assigned to Brummies is not a Brummie accent.
Is that right?
It's a Black Country accent.
So, well, you know, when he said, let me answer, what you actually meant was, let me not answer.
I think
that's what you were saying to me, wasn't it? 1 to 12.
If you were to drag off, you know, the man off the Clapham omnibus and say, give me a Brummie accent, if he could do one, he's going to give you a Black Country accent.
Black Country. You're probably right, because Black Country accent is one of the crowning glories of England. Now, look, it came 12th. I could just give you the answer that you knew was. But I'm with you, Roy Field. I am entirely with you. The Brummie accent is one of the crowning achievements of English culture. There you go. So it's
I wouldn't go that far.
Could I just say the East Midlands accent doesn't even appear on the list?
Well,
nobody.
I tell you, I've always got the accent from Nottingham confused with Yorkshire, if I'm being honest with you, soft Yorkshire. And when I get that mixed up, I say to myself, I'm not a total idiot, because I know that it sits on the other side of the Danelaw. So you have the Angles, the Saxons, the Danes and the Jutes, that these Germanic invaders that come over from Europe from about the 5th century to, I don't know, the 8th century.
Yeah.
And they're supposed to have pushed out the Celtic-speaking Brits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we know that really what they did was just intermarry, but they became the ruling class and they imposed their Germanic language on the Celts.
Yeah.
Then broadly, we have this 200-year period where Vikings then invade. Then after Alfred the Great has his settlement with these Viking invaders. Mm-hmm. And there is a thing called the Danelaw. And basically Wessex, which is in the south, and half of Mercia, really let's call it the West Midlands just for the sake of argument, are England. And the other bits of what is England, so East Anglia, the East Midlands, and the north of England are part of the Danish realm, the Danelaw. And that mapping of the English accents is still writ large now. So then that makes sense to me that to my Brummie ear, you sound like soft Yorkshire. So if you're from Nottingham, you don't sound like you're from... You're definitely not from the West Midlands with that accent. But I can go to Stafford, which is just north, about 5 miles north of Wolverhampton, which definitely would have been on the Saxon side of the Danelaw. And they have so many weird dialect words like nesh for cold,
right,
which sounds to me like Yorkshire. And the right way that they speak is a total clash between the Black Country and, for me, Northern. So really writ large into our mapping our ear on accents, with the exception of received pronunciation, which is different, is the Viking Anglo-Saxon settlement of England. And I love that.
Yeah, man, I love that too. I absolutely agree with you that it's that feeling that there is a historical connection to all of this, that there are things that have happened to create Scouse, for example, to do with the connections over the Irish Sea with Ireland. You know, it's almost like a map of our history. And I love that. I totally agree. I think it's a fantastic thing to celebrate. There are some negatives. I'm going to advance some negatives, Roy, since we're furiously... We're loving it. There was a survey I dug out about the connection. It was Manchester, actually. Mm-hmm. So they did a survey where they took various different accents from around the Greater Manchester area, and they got people to put words against mm-hmm. them. So in the east of Manchester, broadly speaking, you got words like poor, working class, broad, common, rough. In the south, you got multicultural, well-spoken, good, soft, standard, posh. In the west, you got rough, broad, strong, you know, bloody blah, scally, whatever scally means.
Ne'er-do-well,
is that right? So one of the unfortunate things about accents is that it colours you, doesn't it? It gives you, people make assumptions about who you are and where you come from and what you're like based on your accent. And that's a bad thing.
Absolutely. Assumptions on where you come from needn't necessarily be a bad thing if it's not for class and the fact that England is an over-centralised state. I don't know enough about Italian accents, but Italy, for some 1,500 years after the break of the Roman Empire, was a collection of duchies, kingdoms, statelets, principalities, etc. And they all developed separately their version of bastardised Latin, which became Italian. And though Tuscan became the dominant dialect of the unified Italy, if you speak with a Milanese accent, people don't look down at you. If you speak a Venetian accent, people don't look down on you at all.
Right.
Whereas in England, invariably, because received pronunciation is our vestige of our ruling class via the Normans, that is seen uniquely as the best way to speak, and it is the accent of our ruling political and cultural elite, and it's because of that and the over centralized state of England that if I want to make it in media, I've got to go to London. If I want to make it in politics, I've got to go to London. If I want to make it in software, I've got to go to London. As examples, that all of these other accents are seen to a larger or lesser degree as being provincial.
If you want to make it in hosiery, though, Royfield, you've got to go to Leicester, all right?
Or crisps.
Yeah. If you have any ambitions in the world of hosiery, you know, just let me know. Good point. I mean, absolutely, I agree with you. So on this survey that we talked about earlier, where Brummie came, 12 out of 12, received pronunciation was second. So if you have... Well, my kind of accent, it's an advantage in life. So my mother, for example, comes from Yorkshire. She had a Yorkshire accent and she got rid of it. You know, she consciously got rid of it when she came south because it was a disadvantage to her. So I'd say that is still a negative thing. I think it's still stronger than we might think, actually.
I think so too. But you know, I think the history of received pronunciation in and of itself is incredibly interesting. So we associate it with poshness.
We do.
It's that BBC newsreader, isn't it? You know, intoning the news, and you go, okay, this is important. This is serious.
Well, then it's not Hugh Edwards, of course. You know, he keeps it saying.
Well, no, it's actually really interesting. I know Susan Ray, who's a BBC Radio 4 newsreader, a really good friend of mine, and when she delivers the news, I don't hear a Scottish accent. She very clearly has one.
Right.
But it's Scottish received pronunciation.
Right.
You know, it's with authority. And I don't know enough about Hugh Edwards. I haven't really thought about it. But I'm kind of guessing it probably would be the same. It's almost like a Welsh version of the same thing. But, you know, I could be wildly wrong.
Yeah, but I have no idea. But at least he has something of an accent.
No, he does have an accent. There's no two ways about it. And Susan has an accent. There's no two ways about it. But she still sounds posh.
Yeah.
To my ears, he still sounds posh. So there's an element of received pronunciation. I'm going to push back a little bit.
Go on.
I'm with you fundamentally with this, but I think we could have made a whole show really around received pronunciation.
Right.
And because that underlines a very important aspect of English culture, which is the class system.
Right.
And what I was getting around to say before, but you cut me off, you cut my legs from underneath me, was to say that 200 years ago...
Oh, sorry about that.
If I was a lord... and some member of the aristocracy, and you heard me speak,
yep,
and I was from Yorkshire, I would have spoke with a Yorkshire accent. It's only really in the Victorian period where the sons of the aristocracy started to go off to Oxford and Cambridge that this received pronunciation kind of comes into being. This way that the establishment speaks, which then gets underwritten, underlined by the BBC in the 1920s. And then one last thing I'll say about this, about the importance of received pronunciation. Many anecdotal stories in the First World War with officers meeting their troops for the first time. And up until that point, you know, the British Army has, the second Birmingham Battalion or the Lancashire Dragoons.
Yeah.
And so you had lots of people with regional accents and their commanding officers couldn't understand them. Mm-hmm. This is one of the key reasons why Lord Reith says we need a set way of speaking, because bits of the country couldn't communicate with each other.
It's fascinating, that, isn't it? It's very late, isn't it? I mean, it seems incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
We're going on with that, you know, so late. I mean, I can argue, that sounds very interesting. What I can suggest is that you put that forward, that received pronunciation should itself go into the cabinet.
I'm going to put it there and I'm going to, like, you know, barrack it, throw rotten vegetables at it and all sorts
for
every angle. But it should be there. I won't like it.
It should be there. That's interesting.
We
can have nasty things in there as well. Gosh, that opens a whole new can of worms. Okay, I'm going to argue for it going to the cabinet. I suppose we're arguing that it's significant. Accents, I think, help foster a pride of place and where you come from. You know, you can recognize other people. You know, they don't have to look for a bag of Walker's crisps in order to know they come from Leicester. You can tell. I think it fosters pride in that. And I think that's a good thing in England, which, as you say, is very centralized. And anything which helps with, love of regions, I think is great. It gives something for tourists to laugh at.
In fact, absolutely. That we have
weird accents. I like the fact that we now celebrate Saxons much more than we used to do, rather than being embarrassed by them. And, you know, it used to be pure embarrassment, as we've discussed. Now, at least, it's much more accepted. I still think there's a problem, but, you know. So for those reasons, I think it should go in a cabinet.
Mm, probably.
Thing, isn't it? I mean, hate it or loathe it, for the negatives or the positive reasons, accents is one of the things you notice about England, isn't it?
It is. It is. There are loads of kind of quotes around this, but the fact that as soon as somebody opens their mouth, you kind of have a good idea of physically where they've come from in England. But not only that, but their social class denotes how important, what a signifier accents actually are.
You know, I assume that is the same the world over. It would be nice to know more about that, I must admit.
Well, in America, which is where I am now, it's less so important. There isn't the American example of received pronunciation in the way that there is in England.
No.
You know, all middle-class Americans. Yeah, there is regional, but the regional is much broader. So, yes, there is a Southern. Yes, there is a Midwestern accent. Yes, there is a Northeastern accent. There's a New York accent. But the geographic span of these accents is so much wider. And actually, the differences between them are actually much narrower. Mm. Obviously, the extreme, so let's say Northeast, like Boston and Southern, yes, you know, there's a massive difference. But Californian and, let's say, mountain states, I can't tell the difference. And most Americans can't tell the difference, though linguistic experts will tell you there is a difference.
Right.
But it's so, so minor. It's so subtle.
Right.
You know.
Okay, so in conclusion, do we put it in?
Let's put it in and let's have the listeners decide.
Let's have the listeners decide. Before we wrap up, there was a brilliant debate on the Facebook site. Loads and loads of comments. Really good. And Luke has very kindly agreed to follow Fiona and do a quick wrap-up of all of that chat. So, here we are. Over to you, Luke.
Hello and welcome to our second Facebook roundup, following the most excellent Scar episode from Royfield and David. It would seem that ska music has formed the backdrop to many a misspent youth amongst our listeners, like Alice and Mary. During the show, David had put forward three possible objections to ska going in the cabinet, which Royfield expertly batted away. David wondered whether it was just a boy thing, that maybe it was nothing more than frivolous fun, and that it was local to the UK only. Judging by the comments of our listeners, it would appear that none of these objections stand. We've certainly had a lot of women commenting about what ska meant for them. Diane's neighbour was even Terry Hall's uncle. Philip made the case that ska music from the early 80s with multiracial bands like The Specials, The Selector, The Beat, UB40, was the embodiment of multicultural England, a uniting force for the youth of England against the pernicious influence of the National Front, at a vital time in their and the country's development. And we have a lot of listeners from the other side of the Atlantic, which seems to indicate that ska was not just a local thing. It reached Steve in the wilds of Nova Scotia. Well, actually, it was in the suburbs of Nova Scotia, where the choice of music was limited. But a show called The New Music introduced him to the joys of ska. We've had a lot of new members joining the Facebook group from near and far. You can find Callum wandering the streets of York, dressed as a 10th century monk, and occasionally carrying the Duke of York's head on a pike. We've also been joined by Jacob from Cleveland, Ohio, not Yorkshire this time. Jacob wants David and Royfield to cover the venerable melon-farming Bede. That wasn't exactly the term he used, but we hope that this is a family show. And hardly had he suggested it, than David added Bede to the list of topics, along with the Bloody Bard, as he calls Shakespeare. Speaking of suggestions for future episodes, Rowena is proving to be a hard taskmistress, and has already suggested that David and Royfield need to either do more episodes or longer episodes to cover all the topics that have been suggested. And she's got a point. New suggestions have included crumpets and their evil alter ego, the Digestive, from Steeple Bell. As a proud American, Tom suggested that losing the 13 colonies in North America was a thing that made England. Meanwhile, in the MacDonald household, they have been discussing whether there has been a 200-year dialogue of influences that has been a key part in the makeup of what England is today. Mandy from Missouri put forward Wimbledon as being very British. Bill and Debbie wondered to what extent the list we are building represents English or British things. It will be interesting to see how Royfield and David navigate the British-English question, and there was a particularly fine collection of things to add from JW, including tea, Carnaby Street, cricket, real ale, George Orwell, The Kinks, The Avengers, Tribor Mints, Julian Cope, Alfred Hitchcock, the 70s, 80s mod revival, and the Labour Party. Please do come and have a visit of the Facebook page and see for yourselves what is already on the list of topics to be covered. The popular vote has resoundingly gone in favour of ska joining 1066 in the cabinet of things that made England. At the time of recording this, the voting reads 33 votes in favour of ska going into the cabinet, 6 can't decides, 5 nopes, and 3 who chose the option, what is ska? Again, please do visit the Things That Made England Facebook page, as you'll find some great recommendations from members of ska tunes that will fill that gaping hole. This episode really did feel timely given the horrendous Windrush scandal that is going on over here, where we are chucking out the very people that brought ska to these shores. David and Royfield recorded this episode long before the scandal broke into the news in a big way. It is good to know that the members of this group definitely feel that ska, and what it represents, is a thing that made England.
Excellent. Thank you, Luke. And then next time, Royfield, it'll be for you to the proposition, I think. And it's going to be Dunkirk. Very good.
Wicked.
And these are the things that made England.
And St. George!
These are the things that made England.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.